This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, the biggest hog company in the world is in court being sued over how the hog farms, their hog farms or hog farms connected with them, affect their neighbors. It's the second in a series of so-called hog nuisance suits. The first was decided at the end of April. The jury awarded 10 hog farm neighbors over $50 million from Murphy Brown, a subsidiary of Smithfield Foods. A judge later lowered the damages that Murphy Brown has to pay. Catherine Klabe is with us now to talk about the lawsuit. She's senior environmental reporter for North Carolina Health News. Welcome, Kathy.
Good to be here, Frank.
Tell us more about what was at stake with these so-called nuisance. There's more than a nuisance, according to the neighbors, right?
Yeah. The case that was already finished with the verdict in favor of the neighbors was the first of more than two dozen that are being brought in federal court against Smithfield, which is a subsidiary of the largest pork producer in the world.
All right, and what was their claim? What did they say was happening?
Their claim is one that will be familiar to a lot of people in North Carolina who've been following the whole dispute about hog farms. And what they said is that hog farms produce a whole lot of waste, and that they dispose of it in ways that are cheap but have too much of an impact on neighbors, that it's a lagoon and spray system. And so what happens is that they collect manure in these lagoons and then they spray it on these fields, but it doesn't stay in the field. And so people find it floating onto their homes. There's terrible smells and other things that if the companies, these neighbors are saying, if the companies spent the money, just a little bit more money, would have a less of an impact on their communities.
And these open waste lagoons are, I mean, some states have outlawed them entirely, right?
I don't know about that, actually. I'm not sure what the national standard is.
And have some restrictions on, but there are fewer restrictions in the state of North Carolina. So it's sort of interesting going forward. But the other interesting thing is, why not sue the farmer? Apparently they're suing a corporation, right? Smithfield Foods. What's the connection between Smithfield and these farm operations?
That is at the core of these suits. And what is important there is what they're saying is that the largest pork producer in the world, which controls everything that happens on these local farms, has the means to afford something that's more expensive and has less impact.
And the fact is that the contractual arrangements that they have with the producers leads to the conclusion that they should probably take some responsibility.
That's the argument. And so far, one jury agreed with them.
All right. And so going forward now, there's a second case that I think jury selection began today. There are a number of cases. So give us a sense of what's happening legally.
So the first case was in Bladen County. And because there are so many of these cases, the judge asked that in the first case, the neighbors were able to choose their best case, and that's the one they won. In the second case is going to be the defendant, Smithfield's best case, and that is a farm in Duplin County.
And there are, as you say, a number going forward. And we noticed that the judgment was lowered in this case by a judge, $50 million according to the jury, not so according to the judge. And that's because of a state law, right?
Yes. Judge Britt said that there is a state law that limits awards in these kinds of cases. As from what I've been told, the plaintiffs are going to appeal that. There are going to be a lot of appeals in these cases. Yeah. Smithfield is going to appeal the original verdict as well.
All right. Well, let's turn now to someone on the ground in these communities. Naima Muhammad has talked to a number of the neighbors of these large hog operations. She is co-director of the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, which is a community organizer. Naima, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us what you've heard
Thank you all.
Thank you for being with us. Tell us what you've heard from people who are part of these cases.
Okay, so the citizens that's a part of these nuisance cases are community members that's been living in the areas where these concentrated animal feeding operations are, and they've been suffering for a long time with health effects from living nearby those industries, as well as a basic human denial of clean air and clean water, and the loss of use of their property in the way that they intended to use it. They're not able to enjoy their property. They feel like they're negotiating with the air. You know, when they want to go outside, they check first to make sure it doesn't stink. If it's not stinking, they will go outside, rushing to do what they have to do so they can get back inside before the odor comes. And you know, they're not able to hang their clothes on their clotheslines anymore, because if the odor comes while the clothes are out drying, the odor gets into the clothes and they have to redo their laundry.
Now you talked about health effects, too. What are the health effects?
Yeah. So the health effects that we've been able to document through health studies have been elevated blood pressures, upper respiratory problems, high rates of asthma with children living nearby, anger, frustration, you know, just overall not feeling good, nausea, being nauseated all the time, eyes burning, noses running, skin rashes, you know, those kinds of things.
Well, we've heard spokespeople for the industry who have said that, in fact, all of these cases were being brought by outside lawyers who are making a lot of money, and that there really aren't any complaints among the neighbors or not substantial complaints, just an effort to make money by lawyers. We've actually heard that from the industry. What was your response to that?
Okay, so we've been hearing that for years. As a matter of fact, they've been able to convince our legislators that the community people are lying. But again, I say through the health studies and scientific monitoring equipment that's been used in the communities, that's been proven that what people say is what's actually happening to them.
Well, Kathy Klebe, I want to talk about, forgive me, Naima, because there's one other issue here. We've known about the lawsuits for a while, and they've been reported on. We've talked about it on this show. But Kathy Klebe, another victory for neighbors of these big operations over the past couple of weeks, and something we've heard less about. Tell us about the Title VI settlement.
This is fascinating, Frank. It didn't get as big of a splash as the lawsuits and all those dollars that were originally awarded, but community members and with the attorneys who are representing them some years ago brought a complaint to EPA saying the state of North Carolina was violating the Civil Rights Act because it was permitting hog farms in disproportionate numbers in poor neighbors where a lot of black people live. And those are folks that could be viewed, they're arguing that was discrimination that's barred under the Civil Rights Act.
And so what happens, and that's not a legal process, that hasn't resulted in lawsuits, but there was some kind of regulatory settlement that came as a result of this. Am I right?
You are right. It was a long road. But what happened was that folks brought this complaint. Their mediation began. It started, it stopped, started again. In the last round, it started last year. And it resulted in a settlement that could give neighbors to hog farms in North Carolina more leverage than they've ever had before. It's going to require the state to do increased water and air monitoring. There's this argument between some scientific literature, the residents, and the industry about how bad it is. Well, now the state's going to have to go and look for itself. On top of that, the state's going to be required to do what's called environmental justice mapping, and they're going to have to do this analysis, a GIS analysis, that's going to show them where are the farms? Who lives there? Is it true that they are closer to people of these disadvantaged groups?
Naima, I know that the Title VI complaint was brought by your organization, the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, and two others. What do you think of the settlement?
Okay, so we feel that through the negotiating process, the mediation process, that we went to the table with the Department of Environmental Quality, and that we were able to talk through and work through what the concerns were from the communities. And so we feel pretty good about the settlement, that we've gotten probably the best that we can get.
It was, forgive me, continue. Time. Go ahead, continue.
Yeah, that we've gotten at this current time, given the political climate in this state, and the fact that the industry has been very successful in using our legislators against us.
This has been a long time coming. These talks have been going on for quite a while, right? To get you a seat at the table.
Yes, they've been going on. The mediation, the second mediation process, we went 17 months in mediation. The first time we were in mediation, we had to stop because the industry interrupted and into a process that was supposed to be confidential between the complainant and the defendant being the Department of Environmental Quality, the regulator, and which is the Title VI complaint, was filed against the regulatory agency because we felt that they, you know, that their issuing these permits had a disproportionate impact on African-American, Native American, and Latino communities. And that, you know, through all the conversations that's been going on, through all the efforts by my organization, REACH, and the Community-Based Organization, and the Waterkeeper Alliance, who in, for years we have been documenting the impact of what was happening to people living near these operations and making that public information and sharing it with not only our legislators but our, the regulatory agency, and nothing was done because they kept being told that people were lying, even though the scientific documentation and the health status was showing that what people were saying were actually happening to them.
Well, we will pay attention to the process going forward, and thank you so much for your contribution. Naima Muhammad is a community organizer, co-director of the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network. Naima, thank you so much.
Well, thank y'all for listening and giving us the opportunity to share our story.
Catherine Clabby, senior environmental reporter for North Carolina Health News. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, a law professor who studies food policy joins us for a look at how the laws and regulations governing the hog farms have changed in North Carolina, and then we'll hear from the industry as well. The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Talking about the corporate hog industry in North Carolina, it's big. It's become a multi-billion dollar industry over the past few decades, partly because of the way it's regulated. The laws and regulations for hog farms and large confinement operations have changed over time. In 2014, several neighbors of large-scale hog operations filed so-called nuisance lawsuits. We just talked about those. The plaintiffs said that they were prisoners of their own homes because of the horrible conditions outside caused by hog farms. In 2017, the North Carolina legislature considered a bill that would limit damages awarded in active nuisance lawsuits. The law ultimately did pass, with the caveat that it would only apply to future suits. Vanessa Zaboriak is a professor of law at Wake Forest University School of Law, and she studies food law and policy, and she joins us now. Welcome, Vanessa. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Tell us about one of these laws. One of the laws that protects farmers in North Carolina is the Right to Farm Act. So tell us a little bit about that.
That's correct. North Carolina, like all of the states, has a Right to Farm Act. These began to be put into place by legislators in response to suburban growth. To protect ongoing agricultural operations from nuisance suits from newcomers, basically to prevent people from moving into a new development and then suing adjacent agricultural businesses. Mm. And over time, our Right to Farm Act has become increasingly protective of agricultural operations, and it operates in conjunction with a legal schema in North Carolina that doesn't differentiate between crop agriculture and animal agriculture. So if you are any kind of agricultural operation, you can change over into these large-scale animal feeding operations, and it doesn't restart the clock for neighbors who might want to bring a suit in nuisance saying that your use is incompatible with theirs.
Well, now that's interesting because often, I mean, you sort of understand the impulse. Look, if my farm was here and your development moved in, you're not going to start complaining about the smell. You moved here, you knew what you got. But in a lot of these regulations like this, if you change your operation, if you change from one to the other, then we would restart the clock on the statute of limitations. But you're saying I could go from corn to hogs, and we don't restart the clock.
That's correct. And that's even though the impact on neighbors is orders of magnitude greater with most of these animal feeding operations than with crop ag.
And also, there are laws that limit the damages that plaintiffs can receive from these nuisance suits. In fact, they go back to the 1990s, right?
Well, there have always been some limitations on what you can receive, but going forward, where we're going to be after HB 467 is a whole new landscape.
Tell us about HB 467.
So this was the bill that you just referenced that limited the recovery that plaintiffs can get specifically against agricultural and forestry operations. And one of the ways that damages are going to be limited in future suits is that plaintiffs will only be able to recover the diminution of value of their property, as well as any medical expenses that they can plead. But they won't receive any recovery for the emotional distress or the loss of enjoyment of their property that they previously could have recovered.
Now, is this what we've commonly referred to as punitive damages? Same thing?
No, those are two different things.
Two different things.
Damages for loss of enjoyment are, while they might be a rough measure, they're intended to compensate for the harm that people have experienced rather than punish the defendants. Punitive damages are still going to be a theoretical possibility under 467. But that's a lot harder to plead and prove because you have to show some intent on the part of the defendant to cause the harm.
What's the rationale behind this? I mean, on the one hand, it looks like the legislature is protecting, you know, small family farm operations in the state of North Carolina. And actually, you know, farming is maybe an industry that needs protection. Would that be part of their argument?
I think it would be part of their argument, and I think that that argument would hold more true when the Right to Farm Act was originally passed. And there are definitely still small farms out there that benefit from the certainty that a Right to Farm Act gives them. However, as we've seen this consolidation of farms, and particularly the transition from family farms where the farmers owned the livestock to this contract farming where an integrator like Smithfield or Tyson owns the animals from birth to slaughter, we're still, to an extent, protecting the individual farmers, but what we're protecting is a very different type of farming.
Economically. Very different relationship to the land, because they don't own the farms, and they also don't have complete sovereignty over the what we would call inputs. They have to buy certain things from the corporation. So there's not the same kind of sovereignty that a traditional family farmer would have under these new contract agreements.
Well, some contract farmers do own the land that they're farming on. And some of these farmers have had this land in their families for generations. But this conversion to contract farming has certainly, regardless of their ownership status of their land, has changed the relationship with the industry as a whole. They're no longer independent players who are selling onto an open market.
And when it comes time to lobby the legislature, it may be some individual farmers, but also there are these corporations, very large multinational corporations, that are doing the lobbying.
Right. It's both.
Let's talk about the effect this has on local government and local government power, because the question is, and it came up in our last segment, whether or not the local landowners, the people who are bringing this case, the community itself has some say in any of this. And you said that recent laws passed by our state legislature have acted to preempt local control over these areas. Tell us more about that.
So this has been a trend that's gone beyond North Carolina. The effort to preempt local governments, cities and counties, from passing more stringent restrictions. This is something that we see nationwide, particularly in states that have a large agricultural industrial presence. So this tips the balance of power even further in favor of the livestock industry.
Well, tell me if that's happened here, and what are some of the examples of that kind of preemption that may have taken place in the state of North Carolina?
Oh, it's absolutely happened here. This is part of our increasingly robust Right to Farm Act, that the state has limited the ability of local governments to zone out animal feeding operations or to place restrictions on them beyond what the state requires. So individual counties can't require heightened technology for lagoon management. They can't require setbacks beyond what the state requires. And that really ties the hands of neighbors to use more traditional procedures to work out their differences. If they disagree with how their neighboring farm, or really their neighbor, is managing the waste from their hogs, they can't talk it out. And if their agreement doesn't sort, take it to their city council or their county commission to try to enhance protections for them.
And, of course, their neighbor, the farmer, has a new relationship now. It's not just neighbor to neighbor, but now with these contractual agreements, their relationship has become asymmetrical in the sense that they're now associated with a corporation, not just your neighbor, where we'd have to hash this thing out.
And on the one hand, that does give the farmers more protection than their neighbors have. It also ties farmers' hands to a degree, because their relationship with their integrator is one where not only are they not, as you said, sovereign over the inputs and outputs of their farm, but also they don't have the kind of autonomy to select their technology, to determine how their infrastructure is constructed. And the tough spot that they're in is that they don't own the pigs, but they do own the waste.
Mm.
So figuring out how to deal with the waste, that's on them.
Talk about the technologies. You mentioned it a couple times, and there are technologies that would mitigate some of this, right?
We are in development of technologies that could help mitigate the impact on neighbors and also turn biomass into a value-added end product. And some of those technologies include methane capture, which is basically putting a tent over a lagoon of hog waste and capturing the methane so that it can be processed into natural gas. In North Carolina, we haven't scaled that up yet, but that technology is in development. It's out there.
Let's talk more about these technologies now, and I'm going to bring someone into the conversation who's part of the pork industry in the state of North Carolina. Andy Curlis is the CEO of the North Carolina Pork Council. Hello, Andy.
Hey, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks, and thank you for joining us. Let's talk about some of this new technology that we're hearing about, the pork industry. Is there much interest in developing aerators and methane capture, some of the things that could mitigate these complaints?
Yeah, Frank, there is a lot of investment and a lot of projects that are being worked on all across North Carolina to continuously improve the handling of manure, and that is a really exciting aspect of what's going on right now. I liken it to sort of that moment at the turn of the last century, you know, when people are trying to figure out which how they're going to move around, right? And there's gas engines and steam engines, and electricity was being looked at, and canals and railroads, and, you know, there was a lot of investment and a lot of attempts at different ideas. In that time, the gasoline engine obviously emerged in one way, and that same process is underway and has been for a long time in North Carolina, and it's underway right now before our eyes. We are the leader in renewable energy from our farms, and we expect that to continue.
But some other states have really gotten to the point where they don't have these kinds of nuisances. They've been pushing a little higher because they have higher standards and because they've been holding themselves to renewable standards, which we've let slip in this state. We haven't had quite the pressure. Well, let me ask you this.
That's really not the case. I mean, we are the most regulated, most monitored sector of agriculture here in North Carolina than anywhere. We haven't built a new farm in 21 years, and we are highly regulated. Everything that happens on the farm is based on science, soil science, crop science, animal science. And so what happens on our farms is more regulated here than anywhere. No dispute in that.
Is this the time for the industry to maybe make an investment in some of the technologies that I know are being used elsewhere that would mitigate some of this? Because what we're hearing is that individual farmers wouldn't have the wherewithal to employ some of these. You know, if you're going to produce methane, it's not going to be cost effective for them. But for the industry that has integrated them into this much larger network, this financial network, to make that sort of investment and make it possible for them to use these kinds of technologies. Is it time for the industry to make the investment and get it done?
Well, look, starting in late 90s, early 2000, millions of dollars have been spent on just what you're talking about. And, you know, there were very significant public processes underway, you know, 18 different technologies being tested, all funded and supported by the industry. And that's all publicly available. And so that continues.
But I guess my question, Andy, is why is the stuff not in place? Because there are places where this technology is actually being used. So it's not research and development. They're actually using it, and it's mitigating the problem. They're doing it other places. Why not here?
But I guess I don't understand using what where. You know, for example, in Iowa, which is the leading hog state, they generally inject the manure into their cropland. They have vast acres of cornfields, and so what they do is they store the manure, you know, throughout the year, and then bring it out all at once and lay it onto cornfields. That's not the setup in North Carolina. We don't have large farms like that. We don't have large corn operations like that. And so what, you know, may be happening, say, in Iowa is just simply not applicable to North Carolina. Just like in Iowa, they don't grow tobacco, right? And they don't grow Christmas trees, and they don't grow watermelons like we do here. And you're really describing apples and oranges.
Well, let me ask Vanessa Zaboriak whether or not there are any other impediments to applying some of the new methane production, these new technologies that have been proven elsewhere. Vanessa, do you know if there are any impediments?
I mean, sure. One of the things that I think still has to be worked out is how to get this to a tipping point where this is really so economically not only feasible but desirable that industry does install the technology on the farms with whom they contract. And part of that is infrastructure. Part of that is how to get unprocessed methane somewhere central where it can be turned into usable natural gas.
Let me be clear, Frank. I mean, we have a project right now that is doing that, and your organization, of course, has covered that, where we are capturing the methane, injecting it directly into the pipeline, the first natively derived gas to go into the pipeline in North Carolina. That's a project of among our farmers, developers, and Smithfield. And there's a lot that's being learned from that, and I've heard no one say that effort and that energy won't continue. That's part of the continuous improvement that is underway.
Well, let me switch gears a little bit, Andy. Talk about three organizations that have filed civil complaint against the EPA. We talked about this in 2014, that the state allowed large-scale hog operations to set up shop in places where there are larger populations of African-Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. What's your response to that work? That's being worked at the regulatory level and not as an industry lawsuit, but I wonder what your take on all of that is.
Yeah, sure, and I heard your earlier guests describing that. Of course, the key point there is that has reached a resolution, and the resolution is there was no civil rights violations in how the state has permitted the hog farms. And in fact, the populations around our hog farms, no matter how you look at it, half mile, three quarters of a mile, 1 mile, 3 miles, 5 miles, it doesn't matter how you measure it. The population around the hog farms in North Carolina is roughly 60 to 62% white and somewhere around 21, 22% African American. And of course, we have African American hog farmers. My pork producer of the year is African American. And we're just, you know, where the farms are located is a function of, you know, crops, corn, soybeans, where the packing plants are, and we are not just simply objectively not located in African-American communities like that allegation said. And again, the parties to that complaint have agreed that there's no civil rights violations.
Well, let me ask you about this, because you talked about the fact that they're concentrated in places where the other inputs and other parts of the supply chain are. I mean, the argument might be that it's precisely this form of corporate control and integration that's the problem. If you go back to a more sustainable form of agriculture, then the food is always where the hog is. We don't have to use these kinds of very expensive supply chains in order to produce a pork chop. a kind of free-range sustainability means I can be where the pig is where the food is.
Sure. And Frank, I mean, that's obviously how it was in, you know, say the turn of the, you know, 1920s, 1930s, through you know, the middle of the last century. And really, you know, when you go back to that, you, as your other guest mentioned, you're on the spot market. And so what happened is, just the economics are that, you know, you're in a commodity market, and there have been huge wipeouts in the commodity market. 1971 was really bad. There was a period in the 80s. And the last major bad down market was in 98. And a lot of farmers who were operating the way you describe went bankrupt.
Well, they'll argue it's because of the corporatization that came in and made a big footprint and chased them out of business.
Well, that's just not the economics of what took place.
Well,
that's
Andy,
not the case.
We are out of time now, but thank you for joining us. Andy Curlis, CEO of the North Carolina Pork Council. Also heard from Vanessa Zaboriak, who's a professor at Wake Forest University School of Law, who studies food law and policy. Andy and Vanessa, thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the largest pork slaughterhouse in the nation right here in North Carolina. We'll talk about labor disputes there and how they were resolved and how they continue today. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The largest hog slaughterhouse in the United States is in Tar Heel, North Carolina. Smithfield Foods opened the hog processing plant in 1992. Since then, it has had a dramatic effect on the area around the plant, and it was the scene of a long and difficult effort to secure worker rights. Lynn Waltz wrote about the slaughterhouse in her new book. It's called Hog Wild, The Battle for Worker Rights at the World's Largest Slaughterhouse. She's also a professor of journalism at Hampton University. Lynn, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
We just talked about Smithfield opening the slaughterhouse in 1992. So where was the company before this?
Well, it's headquartered in Virginia, and they began thinking about moving to North Carolina because Virginia did not offer it the qualities that it was looking for to expand its own slaughterhouse and to raise the number of pigs that would be required for the world's largest slaughterhouse.
So what are those qualities? What were they looking for?
Well, they were looking for politicians who were open to passing laws that would benefit the hog industry. They were looking for easily subverted or non-existent environmental controls, both for the plant itself and for the anticipated increase in the number of hogs. They were looking for what Vanessa or Kathy were calling the right to farm state, where they could control the supply of pigs in almost a monopoly with 80% of the contracts controlled by them. And then finally, they were looking for low labor costs. So they placed the plant in one of the poorest counties in the country, surrounded by counties with extremely high poverty rates up to 30%, 25-30%.
So there were, at that moment, much stricter regulations, both environmental controls and also controls on how the operation was structured in other places. Is that right? Then more strict than in North Carolina?
Yeah, Virginia had a high, a growing distaste for the idea of these industrial hog operations, but also the state had been going after Smithfield for its slaughterhouse on the Pagan River. And when the state was unable to enforce the law, the EPA stepped in and eventually handed down in federal court in Norfolk the highest, there was $12 million, the highest for the Clean Water Act up to that point.
Going after because it was polluting a river, right? That's why they were
going after. The slaughterhouse itself. This wasn't the hog farms. This was the slaughterhouse. Right. So they when they built the new one on the Cape Fear River, you know, they needed to make sure that they could get permitted because it uses up tremendous amounts of groundwater, and then the wastewater goes into the river.
All right. So now Smithfield is looking for a place that is low wages, low environmental protection, finds it in North Carolina, eastern North Carolina, Tar Heel. It's a place called Tar Heel. What was the impact when that plant was built?
Well, the first thing was the number of hogs. So in 1990, there were about 2.8 million hogs in the state. By 2018, now we have about 9 million.
Wow. So that's a huge increase. And at the same time, we're going to see over this period the number of actual family farm operations is declining. So the people who are growing these pigs is shrinking as this integrated operation increases the number of pigs that get slaughtered there.
Right. So you've got a reverse mirror. In 1986, there were 15,000 hog farms. By 2006, there were 2,300.
Well,
More than 16,000 hog farmers were forced out of the industry, about two-thirds of the 23,400 growers. So this mirrors national trends. 90% of independent hog farmers have been wiped out by the industrialization of the hog farming industry.
And then what's their situation? They get put under a contract. Is that just as good for them? Look, they've got a buyer. They've got somebody who's going to take their pig. What could be better for a farmer than a guaranteed buyer? Isn't this a great deal for them?
Right. Well, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he's a big critic of Smithfield Foods. He calls it a sharecropper or indentured servant system. The hog farmers sign a contract, they mortgage their property, they get the loans, they pay the insurance, they pay the heat, and they're stuck with the poop.
Here we go. So they get all the risk, essentially, and the corporation offloads the risk and then manages the production through contracts like that.
Right.
So what does this do to the community, though? This is basically a crossroads, Tar Heel, North Carolina, and now we see this large operation. What happens to the community?
Well, initially, they did hire a lot of people from the community, including white workers, but primarily African-American workers. But then the work is horrific. It's just horrific. They have three times the injury rate, the average injury rate in manufacturing. It's the most dangerous manufacturing job in America. And so they increasingly began to turn to mainly Mexico to supply workers. And so then NAFTA in 94 opened the floodgates. And so that completely transformed the community surrounding the plant. You went from a very small percentage of the population being Hispanic or Latino up to close to 10%. And this, again, was mirrored statewide. North Carolina led in the rate of immigrants coming in, led the country in the rate of increase of immigrants. About half of them were undocumented, and then that's brought us to today and the issues there.
But meanwhile, ICE began to crack down, and this had an impact on labor relations there. Tell us more.
Right. What happens, they call it La Migra, when the ICE moves in, then the families are disrupted, and as we've seen recently, children even being lost. But when the slaughterhouses get raided, the families are broken up, and then the people flee. So in North Carolina, by the time ICE was done, 2,000 people and their families had simply left the region. So you have a region that was decimated. I mean, the textile industry had been decimated. And these immigrants came in and sort of gave a resurgence to the economy of these small towns surrounding the plant. And then with ICE, then they all fled. So it's been very, very disruptive to the communities.
And what does this do to Smithfield? Because now they've got to go out and hire more workers and replace those who've been lost to immigration, right?
Right. Now, I don't have figures. Smithfield and the UFCW are still operating under a federal gag order from the RICO trial, but that's another story. But I don't have a lot of that data. But when Swift was raided in the largest workforce enforcement in the history of the country, they had to raise wages by 8% to replace the undocumented workers.
And this is the beginning of the... We should talk more about the conditions, and then we'll talk about unionization, because there's about you talk about how dangerous it is. There's a 100% annual turnover at this plant, right?
There has been historically. I don't have figures, from this year or the year before. But historically, in the first decade, and second decade, even into the second decade, 100% turnover.
So conditions are not very good. Wages relatively low, as you say. Once they turned out undocumented workers, they raised wages. Talk about then the efforts to unionize at Smithfield.
The UFCW had to make a huge commitment financially to take on Smithfield Foods, and they went after them. They lobbied. They protested. The campaign was Justice at Smithfield. They documented worker injuries. They opened a center in Tar Heel and Red Springs to try to help immigrants. And Smithfield did not want the union in there, and they broke hundreds of labor laws to keep them out.
And how do we know they actually broke the laws? These were adjudicated cases.
Yes, the National Labor Relations Board investigated and had a 9-month hearing and found that that they had broken labor law and ordered the rehiring of 10 workers who had been illegally fired for supporting the union, not for cause.
And so what are some of the other laws that they broke in the process of trying to keep the union out?
Well, they assaulted. The worst thing that they did was they incited what was called by some a riot. It was a melee, at least. They assaulted a worker, had a couple of workers arrested. But the main thing was intimidation, intimidating workers so that they would not support the union. And the way they did that was that they would pick off the union leaders and fire them and then blackball those workers.
There were periodically efforts to have a vote at the plant, and that's when other forms of intimidation came into play, including asking the county sheriff to kind of circle up and hang around the plant while this vote was going on, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you've got all these efforts, and I think there's another case. Maybe you can give us this example, because I think it's a story that maybe illustrates all of this. Keith Ludlam and his Union Time campaign, and how carefully he had sort of positioned himself so that he followed all of the rules, and still they made an effort to get rid of him. Tell us the story of Keith Ludlam.
Yes, Keith is a colorful character. He was very influential inside the plant, he was one of the workers who had fired. He was fired. He got his job back, and he was the only worker who went back to work inside the plant. In the meantime, he had testified before Congress and had been a real advocate for workers. But when he went back in, he was a target. And according to him, in him telling the story, they knew he had a temper, and they planted somebody in his unit who took him on. And Keith got in a physical fight and then was fired again, and at that point couldn't get his job back.
You talk about this effort to unionize. Eventually, it was a successful campaign, and the union had to be recognized at Smithfield, right?
Yes.
And then shortly thereafter, it was sold. The company was sold to a firm in China.
Right. And this, of course, raises all kinds of issues, again, because the Chinese appetite for pork is probably the highest in the world. And they want more hogs. And right now, the plant slaughters 32,000 hogs a day. If they're operating 24/7, that, you know, you could estimate about 10 million a year. It's just a huge operation. They're capped at 32,000 a day. But the Chinese would like to expand the slaughtering capacity, if not at Tar Heel, perhaps in other states. I mean, if not in North Carolina.
This whole story, you know, there's so many ways to look at this hog industry. You talk about environmental protection, worker rights protection, environmental justice issues along racial lines, all of them. But taken together, it does seem that the very structure of this corporate economy and supply chain and the way farmers are tied and indentured through these contracts and the sheer volume is what gives these corporations the kind of leverage that allows this sort of legislation to get passed. You can see the kind of influence they have on legislatures.
Sure. I mean, some would argue that North Carolina has been corrupted. I mean, some say that Smithfield Foods turned North Carolina into a company town. Wendell Murphy Family Farms, they passed laws and enriched themselves, became extremely wealthy.
Wendell Murphy, I'm going to stop you right there, a North Carolina legislator and a Democrat, while the Democrats were in control. So this is kind of bipartisan. Whatever we're going to say about this, it applies to both parties.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I do want you to continue. I just wanted to make it clear that such is the power of these corporations that almost party affiliation has little to do with it.
Right. So we really have to start to look at the way that we put food on our table and all of these values. So you have the corruption of government, You have the destruction of the environment. You have the destruction of the family farm, and you have workers who are permanently disabled working. Now, the union can help slow the line speed a little bit, but there's still, it's just incredibly dangerous. And you have the ruination of families. We have a system that depends on undocumented workers, and then ICE comes in and raids them, and we destroy those families. So the it's really a microcosm. What's happened in North Carolina and at the Tar Heel plant is really a microcosm for what's happening in the food industry. And as Americans, we consume more meat per capita than any other country in the world. We're just voracious, and it seems that our value system is getting corrupted in the process.
Well, it's
to
hard
to get that cheap meat on the table.
It's hard to see all that you've talked about and we've talked about today in the shrink wrap in the grocery store, right? I mean, that's part of the problem. You're looking at a pork chop, and so you don't see what went into it. And of course, the meat industry will tell you, look, we're keeping the price low, and we're putting food on the table and helping poor people eat.
That's right. And I was at Smithfield headquarters, and Larry Pope and Joe Luter IV, you know, they talked about the profit margins when you're dealing with somebody like Walmart of pennies, that the contracts with those places come down to pennies. And so they have to, you know, that all of these values, that bottom line, they are producing meat that people can afford.
And so what's your response to that? I mean, is there so maybe we should just sort of let it go on so that people can afford to eat in this country?
Well, I think what's important about a show like this is it shows you that we are paying. They're outsourcing the costs of producing the meat. They're outsourcing it on the farmers. They're outsourcing it on the environmental cleanup. They're outsourcing it on the workers and debilitating injuries on the workers. So we are paying. It's just that the cost of the meat itself is kept low.
All right. Well, Lynn Welts is the author of Hog Wild. It is the battle for workers' rights at the world's largest slaughterhouse, also a professor of journalism at Hampton University. Lynn Welts, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about the book and the rest of our show at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Robin Copley is our technical director, with Al Wadarski sitting in. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the North Carolina legislature. Republican leaders have offered their budget package. It offers a pay increase for teachers, $60 million in Hurricane Matthew relief. Democrats say there is no debate, and therefore they have created a secretive process. We'll talk about the budget process tomorrow on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.